FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
This episode of the Financial Survival Network is brought to you in part by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of over 185 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at sandstormgold.com. That's sandstormgold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the New York Stock Exchange American as SAND.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. It's January 7th, 2019. Well, market's taking off. The stock market is up bigly, 175 points. What could be wrong with the world? Gold has even gone up. It's getting close to that 1300 mark. Well, hey, as always, we love when you join the show, when you participate. So just email us, kl@carrylutz.com. We answer all. If your question's really good, we'll read it on the show. And if it's really, really great, we will interview you. Right now, there's about 10, 12 of you whose questions are waiting in the queue. We're going to get to them next week, I promise. Too many important things that we have to get to this week. Anyway, John, happy Monday. And look at these markets. Everything is fine. Nothing can go wrong.
Hey, Carrie. Well, it's still always about the Fed. Now, remember how this is going to go. They'll start with words and go to more and more action-oriented words, and then they'll have to go to action. And that's how it normally plays out. And right now we're in the the beginning stage of the action-oriented words, where they're trying to talk the markets into being optimistic again without actually doing anything. They originally said, don't worry, you know, maybe we'll raise rates less than you expected in 2019. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, we are ready to jump into action if the markets tell us that we need to. In other words, they might do away with quantitative tightening. In other words, they might start adding bonds to their portfolio again by buying them on the open market with newly created currency. In other words, bring back quantitative easing. They might stop raising interest rates and start cutting interest rates. That's what they're promising now if the markets remain unstable. And markets love that kind of talk for a little while. But talk doesn't affect the fundamentals of the world, which right now are kind of dicey. You know, the global economy is rolling over. You've got signs out there that housing is slowing down in a lot of markets. Manufacturing is way down because, in part because of the trade war, and in part because we're 10 years into a recovery. And interest rates had gone up, which was starting to choke off a lot of the interest-sensitive parts of the global economy. One interesting story in all of this is what happened to Apple in the last couple of weeks. They announced that they're the background there is that Apple derives most of its immense earnings from sales of iPhones. Their newest generation of iPhones are really expensive. They're $1,000 for the high-end iPhone,
$1,200.
And that turned out to be not the greatest idea, because there's a lot of pretty good phones for $300-$400 out there. So, you know, what is it that Apple offers that is worth twice the price of a really good phone, you know? And at the same time, the U.S.-China trade war is lowering sales of all U.S. stuff in China. So that hit Apple kind of three different ways there. And their stock has really tanked. They were at I'm not going to get these numbers perfectly here, but they were at $240-something a share, I think, at one point, and they were worth $1 trillion in enterprise value, and they dropped to the mid 100s on all of this. So they were down going on 50%.
30%. Their market cap has dropped 30%. Right now, the stock's trading about 148. Its 52-week high was 233.47. Mm-hmm. So it's down 40-something percent. One nice thing is that the yield is up to 1.87%. The company's not hurting. And like, the reason you buy Apple products is because you like the packaging. They have the nicest packaging out there. Nobody can compare it to their boxes. So right there, it's worth the extra $500, $600, right?
Well, I mean, they do make great stuff. And there's always a market for the highest end whatever. You know, the best car, even if it's $500,000 or a $1,000 phone, you know. But the question is, how big is that market? And that kind of a market, the top-end market, tends to shrink dramatically when confidence in the global financial system tends to drop, because even rich people will pull back if they're worried about, you know, going from $1.5 billion net worth to below $1 billion, to lose that extra zero. So what you're seeing at the top end of a lot of markets is dramatic declines in prices out there. You know, you look in the trophy real estate market right now, and there are all these mansions listed for $17 million, and it just sold for $9 million. Stuff like that is out there all over the world.
We could almost afford one, John, if we took our change box combined, we might be able to buy one.
When gold hits 5,000, let's talk high-end cars.
Then you're not going to want to be seen in a high-end anything, because you will be a target, and it's always good to look like you're living beneath your means and play it low key in that situation. But effectively, I always said that buying a share of Apple is effectively buying an iPhone future. You know, you are buying future sales of the iPhone and not much else. Really, they don't sell many computers anymore, although their computers are really good. I just got a new one. It's well worth the investment. To me, it was an investment. Their watch, hey, I've got one of them. The 4 is an amazing watch, although I don't know if it justified buying it, but I was able to sell my old one on eBay and get a couple $100. And what else do they have? I mean, they have the iPads, and that's it. You know, it's really, you're betting on the future sales of the iPhone, and now they're hitting price resistance and jingoistic, patriotic response of Chinese people who are pissed at the U.S., and just have stopped buying Apple products. That's what you've had, as well as the trade war and all that.
Well, tech stocks in general were priced for perfection 6 months or a year ago. In other words, the world expected basically unlimited continuous growth from these guys, which translated into rising profits. Okay, those two things, they had to become more profitable, and their sales growth had to continue at high double-digit rates. Mm-hmm. For them to be worth what they were worth, you know, where their stock prices were 6 months ago. And those things are turning out not to be quite true. You know, these are still successful companies. Apple has a ton of cash. It's got a lot of good technology. It's got great products. Same thing with Google. You know, they still dominate online ads. They're still a phenomenal company. But their price could drop by half, and they would still be richly valued by most historical valuation measures. So you got air pockets under these stocks. And as soon as the market turns from wildly optimistic to even cautiously optimistic, or let's say guardedly optimistic, there are air pockets under these stocks, which drop them by 30, 40, 50% without any real change in the fundamentals of the company. And that's what we're starting to see now, or what we have seen in the last few months. Now, to get back to the Fed, their words, if history is any guide, will be effective in pumping up asset prices for a little while, and then fundamentals will reassert themselves, and stocks will start to go back down, and the Fed will have to escalate. So I think by mid-2019, the Fed is going to have to either at least have announced that there will be no more rate increases in this cycle, or actually started cutting interest rates. And quantitative easing is going to return by the end of the year. Again, if history is any guide, because that's normally how this plays out. Words don't affect fundamentals in the marketplace. But the governments of the world feel like they need to try words first and see how that goes before they move on to action. So by end of 2019, we'll be back in, 2008, 2009 range as far as monetary and fiscal policy go. You know, all the governments of the world will be running huge deficits, which they are already, but they'll be running even bigger deficits. The central banks of the world will be either easing aggressively, or they will have stopped tightening by then. And then we'll see if we can do it for another cycle. You know, that's the question. Can we do this now with the numbers being what they are?
Yeah, and getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the U.S., when Trump took office. Okay, let's go back to Obama. You know, the national debt, the U.S. federal government's debt was under $10 trillion. When Obama left, it was close to $18 trillion. Now we're heading for $22 trillion. There's a limit. You know, there's a number out there at which this blows up. And we don't know what that number is, but we're heading for it as we increase the debt that's everywhere in the world. And Jay Taylor just published a chart, and I think it was from Incrementum, to make sure that everybody's cited correctly here. But it was a great chart that differentiated between productive debt and unproductive debt and counterproductive debt that was in the system. And the counterproductive debt part of the chart is exploding. It's expanding dramatically while productive debt is not growing at all. And what that means is that the new money we're taking on, the new debt we're taking on, isn't being put to uses that generate free cash flow in the future that will allow us to pay the interest on the existing debt. And, you know, in your own life, in our lives, or in the life of a city or a state or a country, it all works the same way. When you can't cover your interest, your life blows up.
Yes.
And we're headed for that point. Now, what happens at that point is really anybody's guess, because it can go so many different ways. But, I would guess that aggressive easing by the global central banks would lead to rising inflation, which would pump up precious metals prices. So, you know, there's a gold bug play in this prediction that looks similar to what happened between mid-2008 and 2011, 2012 in precious metals when they just took off. So we'll see. But I think with gold down dramatically from its high and the governments of the world getting ready to shift gears pretty aggressively, that this is a pretty good time to be buying gold mining stocks.
Hey, agreed. Well, I'm actually going to read a question here from our FSN community member, Jesse J. I just sold some RCM standard bars and bought certified Liberty Double Eagles minted pre-1907. There is about a $79 difference. It seems to me that the rare coin market is a little more difficult to manipulate than the bullion bank spot price of physical gold. I could be wrong on that, LOL. Is the rare coin market a potential indication of the spot price, or am I just a lucky duck?
Well, there are two ways of looking at bullion versus numismatics. In other words, collectible coins. One way is to use collectible coins as a hedge against confiscation in the future. In other words, if the government comes in and does a 1934 FDR kind of a plan again, where they confiscate gold and make it illegal to own gold, which, you know, we did within living memory, so it's a completely possible thing in the next financial crisis, then collectibles are relatively safe because they aren't seen as competitors with the dollar in the monetary marketplace. In other words, they aren't competing forms of money. They're something that you're collecting because it's rare. And because of that, they might not be confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, they might hold their value better than bullion. If there is no confiscation and we just have a monetary crisis in which gold and silver and other forms of hard assets go up dramatically, then you're paying a pretty big premium to get a collectible that may not work out for you in the end. So it depends on how this plays out. And we can't know that ahead of time. We can't know how crazy things are going to get or what the people in charge are going to do when they're under pressure and they're operating on bad models and they have no idea what's happening because they don't, you know, they don't think it should be happening. So it's possible that a good strategy is to buy some collectibles along with your bullion, you know, and they would go up in a monetary crisis. They just might not go up enough to justify the premium. So, you know, so I don't have a good cut and dried answer on the collectibles versus bullion subject, but I think that either way, it probably works out. And it just depends on which risk you think is more likely and more serious going forward.
Yeah, and I agree. According to Andy Schechtman over at milesfranklin.com, who is an affiliate of the show and good personal friend, he said that the spot price, the differential between those pre-1907 numismatics and the bullion coins of today are at record lows. And, you know, some people speculate, well, it's a millennial thing because they're just not into collecting numismatics. They're too busy cashing in the inheritance from their parents. I'm not sure what the answer is, but probably the price being it's only around $20 more, $30 more premium than a regular bullion coin, you probably can't get too badly burned on it. Because if price of gold goes up 20, 30%, which could happen, it's been that high before, it's been higher, then it's going to make up that $29 a coin differential. And so it's really probably not going to matter one way or the other. We just got one other one that I wanted to read here, John. John and Kerry, it's from Stephen V. Good Austro-libertarian perspectives on the markets and economies are rare, and I rate your podcast very highly. Thank you. From the perspective of investing, I understand that adage that says being early is equal to being wrong. I understand that options and shorting are market plays that require timing and that being too early can have the same financial results as being wrong, but it is not the same thing as being wrong when it's truth and understanding. So, you know, and he goes on to disparage the stopped clock analogy because, you know, we're not saying go play this, that it's going to happen tomorrow. And we've never said it. We've always said that the timing will surprise you and not be of a time of yours or our particular timing, but that this is where we're headed. So maybe it's more important to sound the alarm when everybody else is complacent and thinking that the stock market only goes up. Maybe that's our function here, John.
Yeah, no, that's all true, Kerry. I was just saying that it would have been a lot better if we had understood the dynamic of quantitative easing and how much money they were pumping out and where that money would flow. You know, I thought that, you know, one scenario would be that that everything tanks. Mm-hmm. And the other scenario would be that everything goes up, including gold and silver. So that if even if quantitative easing sends stocks up, that gold and silver would go up for the ride. They would be one of the assets that all this quantitative easing cash would have flown into. And it didn't happen, which means that we missed an opportunity to own Apple and Google and Facebook, et cetera, on that nice 2 or 3 year run that they had, which means that being pro precious metals wasn't a great call, you know. And I think we need to acknowledge that the fact that we got that wrong means that anything we have to say about timing going forward has to be taken in light of the fact that we don't always get the timing right, you know, and the overall theme of the next decade, I'm 100% certain is going to be monetary crisis and capital flows from financial assets into real assets. You know, I'm sure that's going to happen. But the timing of it is the tough part of this. And, you know, it does feel like we're getting closer to that time, though. As financial assets get more and more volatile, mm-hmm. And more scary, then it's harder to be complacent in those markets. And it's harder just to, you know, to commit all your capital to the FANG stocks like you could have done 3 years ago and been brilliant. But now you're not brilliant if you do something like that. So you need to diversify. And I think real assets are part of that diversification process. So we're going to see, or we are seeing now, capital flows in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I think that continues going forward.
I agree too. Hey, we'd be remiss if we didn't really cover the yellow vest revolution that's taking place in France and spreading to the UK it's spreading like all over the place. And it just shows that when the ruling class, when the government gets so divided and so antithetical to the common people, that eventually they're going to strike back. I would have thought it would happen in Great Britain after Brexit and after they're being screwed around with on the whole Brexit negotiation on how UK will split from the European Union. But no, it's happened in France. And then they went around last week, arrested a bunch of the leaders of the Yellow Vest Revolution, thinking, oh, that'll help calm it down. And instead, they were out there on Saturday. They broke down the doors of the ministry. It was the foreign ministry or the financial ministry, I don't know which. They also burned the doors of the Bank of France. I mean, these people kind of get what's happening here, and they understand who has been victimizing them and the reverse Robin Hood effect right here. I mean, it's all across the political spectrum, John, in France, from right to left and in the middle and ultra and you name it. They are like one unhappy group of people there.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice for the French government to make, where after they'd already caved to the demands of the Yellow Vests and tried to placate them with policy changes that they thought would make those guys happy, they go right out and arrest the leaders of the movement. Like they thought that they'd already won, and by cutting taxes a little bit or something like that, that would allow them then to shift gears and appear to be tough on civil unrest. And it didn't work. You know, those guys took right back out to the streets, and now they're back where they started, only there's even less trust in the central government.
No trust.
Than there was. Yeah.
There's no trust. I mean, they're like, they've lost it. Whatever claim of legitimacy the French government had, I think is gone. And Macron's going to come to that, that come to Jesus moment and decide that time to recall a snap election because I can't govern here. And the lack of governability, contrast with the United States, we're in the third week of a 25% partial shutdown of the government. Unless you're in a national park or work at the IRS or you're a poor, downtrodden federal employee who just doesn't get paid enough and doesn't get enough time off and not enough benefits. Outside of that, nobody's really feeling the pain here. And really, if you're in a government worker and you're forced to work and not get paid, there's a lawsuit going on about that. Governability. What's going to happen here in the U.S., John?
Well, the U.S. has a lot of angry people across the spectrum, just as you said, France does. So we tend not to be as civil unresty across the board as Europe. You know, they take to the streets at the drop of a hat. That's just the normal political process over there. And they celebrate it when it happens. You know, the student revolt of 1968 is still a positive.
I remember that.
Event in French history, you know, and it doesn't work that way for the U.S. We require more specific kinds of things like police brutality or something like that that brings the targets of police brutality into the streets. And part of that is that we're not as heavily taxed as most of Europe is. You know, France is the most heavily taxed country now in Europe. So everybody has a reason to be mad about that. And then you got immigration, which is also more extreme there than it is here as an issue, and also tends to bring people out into the streets. So here, this government shutdown thing is just Trump being Trump, really. He is willing to take extreme stands and to play chicken with his political opponents. He's doing that with China right now, where, you know, we're finding out whose economy is hurt more by a trade war. And Trump is betting that China's is, you know, because they've got a history within living memory of civil unrest that leads to revolution or leads to civil war, which leads to revolution. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything like that. And we're not as prone to that kind of thing. So he's betting that China is more terrified of civil unrest than they are of changing the terms of trade, and that he can get a deal out of this. And that's why we've got this trade war that's going on and on, when nobody else at any part of the on any part of the political spectrum in the U.S. was willing to take that on. Now, it's the same thing with shutting down the government. We've had government shutdowns in the past, and the party in power has always blinked and always given up. And usually it's the Republicans, because they see more of a downside to a government shutdown when they're in power. And Trump isn't suffering from that affliction. You know, he doesn't seem to be too worried about what happens with the government shutdown. And because the Democrats care more about the people who are hurt by government shutdowns than Republicans seem to, Trump is betting that they'll be the ones to blink, and they'll give him his money for his wall, you know, and that's a game of chicken where the outcome isn't guaranteed. So we don't know how this is going to turn out, and we don't know how long it's going to last, and we don't know whether it's going to lead to some kind of civil unrest that looks like France. It's you know, unlikely right now, but let nobody get their paychecks and nobody get their welfare payments and food stamps, et cetera, for another month. And then we'll see, you know, we'll see what it turns into. It's a big bet that everybody's placing right now, that, that their side will be able to hold out longer than the other side, and the other side will blink. Now, you know, one of those at a time is tolerable. And if you get three or four of them, it becomes kind of overwhelming. And we've got two now, at least two, between the trade war and the government shutdown. So we'll see how it goes. It's to put this on a broader stage, this is what happens when you run out of money. You know, when you borrow too much money and you can't take care of all the constituencies that need to be taken care of, you get crazy stuff like this. So we shouldn't be surprised that it's happening, because when you borrow too much money and you can't pay your debts, crazy things happen. You know, you don't know what the crazy thing will be, but you know some kind of a crazy thing is going to happen. Now let us get into some kind of an actual shooting war, that's another place where we're playing chicken on a lot of different levels, that costs us a ton of money, that goes on top of the trillion plus dollars a year we're already borrowing at the federal level. And then who knows, you know, maybe that's the thing that breaks the financial back of the world. We don't know, but could be. There are a lot of things out there in prospect right now.
Could be. Hey, 2 points I would just like to make. Number one is that a high-ranking guy in China was censured by the government for stating that the growth rate of the Chinese economy was under 2%. So they've never had reported growth rates that were below 6 or 7%. To think that the actual rate's down to less than 2%, that is depressionary levels for China. And the other thing I just want to point out, as far as the shutdown is concerned, well, you know, it's going to be a while, obviously, but Trump has an ace up his sleeve, because originally he said they're going to make it out of concrete, kind of like those noise attenuator barriers that you see along the highway. But now he's talking this steel, they're basically steel panels that you can see through with big points on top, kind of like a medieval fence in front, you'd see in front of an English castle. My guess is that the cost to build those prefabricated panels is a fraction of what the cost is to actually build concrete walls, because they're, you know, you got to put in these huge, like, holders. I don't remember what they call them. They're these connectors, and they go for mile after mile after mile. With the fence, you got to put in footings, all right? Maybe you have to do stuff so they can't go under this panel, this barrier, as they call it. But in some ways, it's more effective because you can see through it. It's not a fence. Can't be cut through with a pair of bolt cutters. I think that the cost of the wall is actually way, way less than the $25 billion that he said. And he'll almost be able to finish it with this $5 billion, which is why the showdown. But that's just a theory. That'll be borne out or not later on. And that's it for us for this Monday, January 7th, 2019. We are out of time. But John, I think we raised some really good points. I think you need to be listening and paying a lot of attention to these details, these market gyrations, these political gyrations, and these geopolitical gyrations, because they are going to affect your future. You need to be planning. You need to have things in place, because you just never know when something is going to hit the fan, and then you're left running around not knowing what the heck to do. Anyway, find John's work over at dollarcollapse.com. Find our work over at financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for both our newsletters. And if you're watching this on YouTube, which hopefully this will be posted, the audio is posted separately on YouTube, then please subscribe, like, and share us. If you're just listening to the podcast, share us with somebody. It really helps the show when you do that, helps get the message out, helps get people more knowledgeable about what's really going on in the world. John, we'll catch you next week. Thanks.
Thanks, Gary. See ya.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.